our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, lawyers for Portland 6 defendant Patrice Lumumba Ford win the right to appeal his sentence for a seditious conspiracy. The U.S. Supreme Court hears two major cases on racial integration in elementary and secondary schools, and Hugo Chavez wins re-election as president of Venezuela.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,904 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports that only 55,021 civilians have been reported in the media as killed in the Iraq Civil War. And a new media report in the medical journal The Lancet places a civilian death count at more than 650,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 4th, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Portland 6 defendant Patrice Lumumba Ford was convicted of seditious conspiracy 3 years ago and sentenced to 18 years in prison. Now his attorney has won the right to appeal his prison sentence, arguing that his prison term should be shortened because the judge in the case made a mistake in the sentencing guidelines. That appeal started with hearings this morning at Pioneer Square Courthouse. KBOO reporters Chris Andre and Trillium Shannon attended the first day of the hearing, and this is their report.
This morning, over 50 community members gathered at the federal courthouse in Portland to show their support for Patrice Lumumba Ford. Before the hearing, Kent Ford described the political climate when his son was arrested, along with five other Portland Muslims.
John Ashcroft indicted all these Muslims after 9/11, and there was one conviction in Detroit. 2 months later, it was overturned and unraveled. And all these cases here were set up where the feds send informants into the mosque, recruit and infiltrate the mosque, and run into the mosques with body wires and tape recorders, recording what the imam is saying, which is against the Oregon Constitution. And so we're saying is that these guys here, they did nothing. They traveled to China, they came back. It's just that simple.
Portlander Sandy Polishek agreed that Ford was sentenced unfairly.
I think that he was kind of railroaded and given a crazy sentence, crazy long sentence. It was all part of the hysteria after 9/11, and, you know, I'm against the whole act that he was sentenced under, so I want to support him.
Attorney Sean McCray represented Patrice Lumumba Ford in front of the U.S. 9th Circuit Court of Appeals, arguing that the 18-year sentence that Ford received was based on the crime of treason, which was not an appropriate sentencing guideline for her client's case. Ford was convicted on a charge of seditious conspiracy. According to McCray, government attorney Dave Atkinson stated in a government brief that seditious conspiracy differs from treason in name, essential elements, and sentencing. Having heard testimony from McCray and Atkinson, the legal decision resides with the judges. Community organizer Casey Jama represented the sentiments of many supporters.
There's a lot of people, and I think the court is full, so that's a really good sign. And I think we're hoping that Patrice Lumumba sentence will be reduced, and hopefully he will be out of jail very soon. That's our best hope right now.
The circuit court has no set date for deciding the appeal. Kent Ford said that letters and calls in support of Lumumba can make a difference.
You write letters to the Senate Judicial Committee, the new Senate Judicial Committee, John Connolly and Patrick Leahy. You might also want to call your congressman or your Senate. And this Justice Department here, this U.S. Attorney's Office here, this district is just out of control. I mean, it's got something against Muslims, you know. It's just, and I don't know, it's racism and race and religious profiling. That's the only reason my son's in jail.
For KBOO News, I'm Trillium Shannon.
Citing the state's revenue windfall, Governor Ted Kulongoski proposed a two-year budget that calls for increased funding to several state services. The latest budget projection predicts that the state will have at least 20% more than the $12.5 billion that lawmakers thought they would have when they set the current two-year budget. Kulongoski proposes spending $8 billion on his education enterprise budget. That amount includes more than $6 billion for K-12 schools, which represents a 14% increase over the current two-year budget. The new budget also calls for hiring more state troopers and extending health coverage to thousands of uninsured Oregonians. And this will be the first time that Kulongoski has proposed a budget to a legislature controlled by the Democrats.
Congress is back in session today, giving Oregon's congressional delegation one last chance this year to agree on a final bill that would expand wilderness protections to Mount Hood. KBOO's Mike Monkfold has more.
Oregon's congressional delegation is running out of time to deliver Oregonians the gift of wilderness in time for the holidays. Congress reconvenes today, and it's the last opportunity this year for Oregon's senators and representatives to reach a final compromise on a bill that would expand wilderness protections on Mount Hood. Ivan Maluski, with the Sierra Club in Oregon, says there's wide agreement on most of the issues.
Any differences should be able to be worked out and give the people of Oregon a great present this holiday season.
Ken Raitt, with the Campaign for America's Wilderness, says if the delegation arrives at an agreement quickly, it will be the first new wilderness on Mount Hood in 20 years.
We believe this is the best gift that we can give our children and future generations.
The Oregon News Service contributed to this report. I'm Mike Monkvold, KBOO News.
Governor Ted Kulongoski says there's hope for stability in Afghanistan, but he saw only further deterioration in Iraq on a visit to U.S. troops. Kulongoski joined the governors from New York, New Jersey, Utah on a week-long trip to Iraq and Afghanistan. Kulongoski spent more than an hour meeting with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, in addition to visiting Oregon Army National Guard troops. Kulongoski said a big concern is that the American public doesn't distinguish between the two conflicts and may link efforts in Afghanistan with their feelings about Iraq. On the way home, Kulongoski stopped in Germany, where he toured a U.S. military hospital and visited with several Oregon soldiers and Marines wounded in combat.
A guilty plea was given in Virginia today from a Salem, Oregon soldier accused of espionage, desertion, and other charges. Petty Officer 3rd Class Ariel Weinman is accused of stealing a Navy laptop and peddling its classified contents to an undisclosed foreign government. Weinman faces a life sentence without parole, a dishonorable discharge from the Navy, and forfeiture of all pay. Under a plea agreement, Weinman pleaded guilty to espionage and desertion, among other charges. Weinman pleaded guilty in trying to transmit classified information related to national defense to a representative of a foreign government in October of 2005.
A Philippine court today convicted a U.S. Marine of raping a 23-year-old Filipino woman last year. They sentenced him to 40 years in prison. Three other co-accused were acquitted for lack of evidence. Gurley Lanao reports.
Hundreds of people who gathered outside the courthouse in Manila's financial city of Makati broke into cheers and applause when the verdict was announced. Inside, the complainant, identified only as Nicole, cried as soon as Judge Benjamin Pozon said he was convinced that Lance Corporal Daniel Smith took advantage of her alcohol intoxication to sexually abuse her on November 1, 2005. The decision marks the first time for an American soldier to be convicted of sexual abuse against Filipino women in the country. But the fight is not yet over for Nicole. Lawyers for Smith are invoking a security agreement between the Philippines and the United States in seeking that their client be turned over to the U.S. Embassy while they appeal the court's decision. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao.
A Salvation Army church pastor accused of kissing and fondling two girls from his congregation will be arraigned in Yakima tomorrow. 65-year-old Eduardo Alfaro was jailed last week with bail set at $100,000. The Salvation Army says he was suspended in October after it learned of the allegations.
A body recovered from the Cumberland River in Tennessee has been identified as a missing Fort Campbell soldier from Washington State. Specialist Josiah Jameson of Bellingham disappeared November 16th, 2 days after returning to Clarksville, Tennessee, on leave from Iraq. An Army Criminal Investigation Command spokesman confirmed Jameson's identity today. The cause of death is still pending, but officials have not said whether his foul play was suspected. Gray urged anyone with information about the case to contact the police at Fort Campbell authorities.
A North Carolina teenager accused of robbing a student of two new PlayStation 3s was shot to death by police sent to arrest him. Peyton Strickland was killed Friday at a house he shared with three roommates, New Hanover County Sheriff Sid Causey said. Strickland's roommate said Strickland was unarmed, but may have been holding a video game controller when he went to the door as officers bashed it in. The State Bureau of Investigation is examining the case, and three deputies on the team were placed on paid leave. Causey said Strickland was shot by members of a special police unit who went to help university officers serve warrants.
KBOO reporter Martha Odom started to put together a story on the problems TriMet riders are experiencing with the coin machines. But then the deeper she dug, the more complications she found. So instead, Martha put together a commentary on why TriMet is the bus service we love to hate.
TriMet runs 91 bus lines and 44 miles of regional light rail system that in fiscal year 2006 supported 32.6 million max trips. Under construction to be completed in 2008 is 14.7 miles into Washington County, shared use with Portland and Western Railroad, that will attach Wilsonville, Tigard, Tualatin to the Beaverton Transit System Center and the rest of the line. Additional expansion on these rails is possible to Eugene, McMinnville, and Astoria. Also under discussion is an I-205 project, which will bring light rail service into Clackamas County. Expansion fever, however, may be at the expense of maintaining existing services. Rush hour crowding on MAX and many bus lines is excruciating. Passengers may well wait for two or three trains to go by before there's space available. MAX is limited to three cars based on the length of Portland City blocks. Proposals are being discussed to put rail underground, which would be an enormous project, both in expense and in construction disruption. There is serious discussion of eliminating Fairless Square. Citing reasons are undesirable behavior, it invites terrorism, and leads to fare evasion by passengers who ride outside Fairless Square. The Portland Visitors Association has vowed to oppose any attempt to abolish Fairless Square in its 30 years it has become part of the personality of downtown Portland and is a charming attraction for visitors and tourists. Increasing rider complaints about fare inspectors and bus drivers have flourished recently. Once upon a time, TriMet bus drivers were some of the most charming, helpful people around and were definitely part of the Portland personality. TriMet officials were not surprised when I related witnessing fare inspectors treating two young women as criminals who may only have non-validated tickets because the validating machines were broken. Problems with ticket vending machines and ticket validators are epidemic throughout the system. Mary Fetch, TriMet's communications director, points out that the machines are 20 years old, are wearing out, replacement parts are unavailable. Machine replacement starting on the west side needs fiber optic cable. The cable's being laid now and won't be complete until next year. New machines will accept credit debit cards, but TriMet says that they will leave one cash machine in each location and that missed income from broken machines is, quote, not yet an emergency. Mary Fetch also said to inform riders that the ticket vending machine complaint line is 503-962-2444. You heard it first on cable. You will not see this posted on any of the machines, one, two of which were broken on my way into KBOO this morning. Mary also advised that riders should really buy their tickets at Safeway or Fred Meyer. Hopefully they're not too far from the MAX line. For KBOO News on TriMet, this is Martha Odom.
Business owners are getting a timely reminder from the Oregon Department of Revenue this week. The department wants them to remember they need to file a tax return with their county assessor by March 1st. The forms go out in December. Business owners need to list all business-related personal property, including purchase and lease dates, as well as amounts on other forms. The property tax business owners must pay on the assessed value of that property is due every November 15th.
The Oregon Board of Education is considering the pluses and minuses of changing the math requirements for high school students. The contentious proposal would require students take Algebra 1 and two additional math classes above that. In most cases, classes would be Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2. The state is also calling for more credits in two other areas, the second language slash arts category and science. But some people are concerned that students won't be able to reach these requirements. Oregon ranks near the bottom nationally when it comes to graduation standards.
Oregon Health and Science University is hosting a conference on cancer prevention this week. The meeting in Portland will focus on ways to promote healthy lifestyles aimed at preventing cancer. The conference is one of just four meetings scheduled across the country by the President's Cancer Panel, a national organization formed in 1971. The conference organizers say Oregonians are known for their love of exercise and healthy food. And they say Oregon is the only state where obesity has not been increasing. The Portland meeting will include doctors, public health experts, and community leaders. The public is also invited to attend the day-long event.
Researchers at Oregon State University are working on a new way to reduce chemical pollution with seaweed. Chemical engineering professor Gregory Rohrer is studying whether the metabolic processes of certain seaweeds can be used to break down a class of pollutants into less toxic matter. These pollutants are often found at harmful levels in ports and harbors where fuel oil or coal is burned. Pollutants also hurt marine invertebrates like clams and oysters. But preliminary research done at Oregon State suggests that seaweed can help remove harmful pollutants, compounds in seawater. Researchers are still trying to figure out what happens to the pollutants after they are broken down.
Revenues from the city of Astoria may get a boost from two of the region's most abundant resources, wind and water. City leaders are hoping to transform the water that tumbles over Astoria's 90-year-old dam and the wind that howls on Wickiup Ridge into electricity and sell it to Pacific Power. They've applied for a $500,000 state grant to explore going into the electricity business. Astoria's city manager, Paul Benoit, says they would be selling power to Pacific Power. Although the focus is primarily on hydropower, Benoit says the city will also look at wind resources. A study by Oregon State University about 15 years ago determined that Wickiup Ridge is one of the windiest spots on the lower Columbia River.
Dallas-based TXU Corporation has applied for fast-track permits that would allow it to build as many as 17 coal-burning power plants across Texas. TXU claims that the falling wholesale prices are squeezing its profits. State hearings on the permits began last week, and federal hearings are set to begin in January. Groups opposing TXU include the cities of Dallas and Houston, the Sierra Club, Environmental Defense, and the Natural Resource Defense Council. Farm and ranch organizations and church groups are also opposed. The plants would produce an estimated 78 million tons of carbon a year, making Texas the ninth largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. TXU is also requesting permits for two nuclear power plants.
Washington Governor Christine Gregoire has announced a state probe of three ex-convicts who were implicated in the deaths of three Seattle-area law enforcement officers. At a wide-ranging news conference, Gregoire also reaffirmed her support for the death penalty and announced $400 million in business tax relief. Since August, three inmates on post-release supervision have been accused of causing the deaths of three law enforcement officers. Gregoire has also directed the Washington Department of Corrections to study the cases of each inmate. King County Deputy Sheriff Steve Cox was the latest victim early Saturday.
Portland's infamous sit-lie ordinance is moving north. The Olympia City Council may vote today to ban aggressive panhandlers who block sidewalks. The council is reacting to complaints that panhandlers discourage shoppers from going downtown. The proposed ban is opposed by homeless advocates. Olympia's measure would make it illegal to sit, lie down, sell things, or ask for money within 6 feet of a downtown building.
Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius will assume the chairmanship of the Democratic Governors Association next year as the party enjoys its first gubernatorial majority in 12 years. Sebelius, who was elected to a second term last month, will succeed New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. Her vice chairman will be West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin III, who was elected in 2004. Richardson is ending his term while weighing a bid for the presidency in 2008. Next year, Democrats will control 28 seats to the Republicans' 22. The results reverse the GOP's 6-seat advantage. By another calculation critical to the party in 2008, Democratic governors will control states with 295 electoral votes, more than the 270 needed to win the presidency.
Incoming House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wants to fast-track efforts to boost the federal minimum wage and could seek to bring the bill directly to the House floor in January. A new Democrat-controlled Congress convenes on January 4th, and Pelosi has made it clear that raising the federal minimum wage is a top priority. The legislation is likely to call for a phased-in increase in the current minimum federal minimum wage from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour, along the lines of a proposal written by Representative George Miller. Attempts to lift the federal minimum wage during the Republican-controlled Congress all failed. At this point, she says her preference is for a standalone minimum wage bill that is not tied to other legislative endeavors.
The Supreme Court hears two major cases dealing with school integration in elementary and secondary education. One case deals with the Seattle school system, the other, Louisville, Kentucky. In both cases, white students were denied their school of choice because of mandatory integration policies. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, hundreds of students rallied outside the court, chanting in favor of school integration policies.
On this cold Monday morning, hundreds of students, mostly students of color, but of all ages, rallied in front of the Supreme Court in hopes to influence a case they say is important. Kyle Coleman is a freshman at Syracuse University.
I believe very firmly in it. I believe, you know, it evens out the playing field.
Carmel is 10 years old. She and her mother came from Detroit.
I want to keep Thurgood Marshall's dream alive.
The two cases could reverse policies that ensure school integration, something that was implemented by the Supreme Court decision Brown v. Board of Education more than 50 years ago. Civil rights groups and local school boards have rallied around this issue. They fear segregation will result from lax integration policies. The other side has the support of the Board of Education and the Solicitor General of the United States. They support a Seattle parent who sued because her white child was denied admittance to a Seattle high school where race is used as a tiebreaker in determining which student gets in. In Jefferson County, Kentucky, a parent sued because their kid was denied admittance because the school already filled race quotas. In both cases, the plaintiffs say school integration plans deny students equal opportunity guaranteed in the 14th Amendment because race is a deciding factor in school placement. Sharon Brown is the lead attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Our Equal Protection Clause requires the school districts to look at the students as individuals. They have the right to be treated equally without regard to their race.
The plaintiffs compared their argument to a 2003 case in which the Supreme Court ruled against affirmative action. The University of Michigan Law School cannot solely use race as a factor in deciding admissions. But Justice Breyer, along with Justices Souter and Ginsburg, dismissed any such comparison.
It was an elite merit selection academy. And if you put the black person in, the white person can't get the benefit of that. Here we have no merit selection system. Merit is not at issue. The object of the people who run this place is not to create a school better than others. It is to equalize the schools.
The respondents, the local school boards of Seattle and Jefferson County, say school integration benefits the community and helps to provide equal education and resources in all schools. Francis Mellon Jr. argued the case for the Louisville School Board.
Jefferson County does not want to go backwards. We've gone through state-sanctioned segregation. We now have a voluntary plan. We think it works, and we don't want that taken away from us. That's the point I was trying to make.
Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, both newcomers to the court, questioned the effectiveness of integration policies. Justice Kennedy, who could possibly tip the scales in one direction, was the first to ask a question and continued to quiz all sides. This could be one of his most telling remarks.
You are characterizing each student by reason of the color of his or her skin. That is quite a different means, and it seems to me that should only be, if ever allowed as a last resort.
While the court was arguing inside, some students remained outside, including these kindergarten students who attend a school just blocks from Supreme Court. And for them, their message is simple.
Good school!
The decision is expected next summer. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Parents who sued a Southern California school district over a sex survey given to elementary students have lost before the U.S. Supreme Court. The poll was given to children in the first, fourth, and fifth grades. Justices declined to review an appeals court ruling that dismissed the suit against the Palmdale School District. Parents claimed their constitutional rights were violated when the district conducted surveys that asked students how often they thought about sex. However, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said the parents of public school children have no, quote, fundamental right to be the exclusive provider of sexual information to their children, unquote. But the district dropped the survey in 2002 amid complaints from parents.
A coalition of civil rights and privacy advocates are urging the U.S. government to reject a new program slated to begin this week that could create secret terrorist ratings on tens of millions of American citizens. Groups say the proposal looks suspiciously like part of the controversial Total Information Awareness Program, which the government was forced to abandon. FSRN's Catherine Comp reports.
The Automated Tracking System program was initially proposed for screening cargo, but last month, the Department of Homeland Security quietly issued a notice expanding the program to include travelers. The program would assign a risk assessment to millions of people seeking to enter or exit the U.S. Groups say it's essentially a terrorist risk rating that will determine whether people are searched and even allowed to enter or exit the country. Melissa Noh is with the Electronic Privacy Information Center.
We believe that this system needs intense scrutiny and that it will most likely turn out to be illegal when there is intense scrutiny put upon it.
DHS calls the program one of the most advanced in the world. The agency said it will identify suspicious or unusual behavior using a set of constantly evolving rules. However, DHS itself admits there are privacy risks, including inaccurate information used against people who may not be aware that the government is compiling data on them. For FSRN, I'm Catherine Comp.
The New York Times reported today that an unclassified Pentagon video shows alleged terrorist Joseph Padilla in chains and wearing sensory deprivation headphones and blindfolds. The images demonstrate the harsh tactics used by U.S. interrogators while he was in military custody as an enemy combatant, his lawyer said today in court papers. The video images are the first publicly released of Padilla's 3.5-year detention at the Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina. They were filed late Friday in federal court in Miami as part of an attempt by Padilla's lawyers to get the criminal terrorism support charges against him dismissed. Federal prosecutors and Pentagon officials have repeatedly denied that Padilla was tortured.
President Bush met today at the White House with the Shiite leader of the largest bloc in Iraq's parliament. Bush said he told his visitor from Iraq that America supports the government there, but he also made it clear he's dissatisfied with the pace of efforts to stop the violence. The president says he told his guests that elected leaders have to reject these extremists. The Shiite leader says his country should be in a position to solve its own problems. But he also acknowledged asking that U.S. troops remain there. Bush meets later this week with British Prime Minister Tony Blair and next month with a Sunni leader.
Confirmation hearings on Robert Gates, President Bush's nomination for Defense Secretary, begin tomorrow in the Senate Armed Services Committee. FSRN's Nan McCurdy reports from Capitol Hill.
In 1987, Gates had to withdraw his nomination when it became evident the Senate would reject it. Gates was told by a chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, David Boren, that, frankly, Bob, the committee doesn't believe you. In regard to the Iran-Contra affair, where funds from covert arms deals with Iran had been diverted to buy weapons for the U.S.-backed Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Melvin Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, was director of Soviet foreign policy studies in the Directorate of Intelligence at the CIA from 1966 to 1990.
Gates denied knowing about the diversion of funds. He denied knowing about the missiles from Israeli inventories and American inventories that were delivered to Iran. And he denied knowing about the exorbitant prices that the Iranians were being charged to create this pool of money to give to the Contras. So he was fully briefed on Iran-Contra. So he was behind the phony assessment that was written in 1985 to make it appear that the Soviets were behind the assassination attempt against the Pope.
Robert Perito, who worked for Gates at the National Security Council, is a senior program officer at the U.S. Institute of Peace, a nonpartisan institution established and funded by Congress.
I used to work for Gates. I think very highly of him. He's an extremely capable public servant. I think that he will, you know, take a fresh look at what's going on and will, you know, make adjustments as he sees they're required.
Ray McGovern was in the analysis division of the CIA for 27 years and is opposed to the nomination of Gates, with whom he worked.
This is a very important nomination, and actually is the first test of whether the Democrats, who emerged victorious on the 7th of November, or whether they're going to insist on following the Constitution. Their constitutional responsibility is to vet a nomination like this very carefully. And if they get swept up on just one factor, and that is that Robert Gates is not Donald Rumsfeld, that is abnegating their responsibility under the Constitution to advise and consent on such nominations. We need a Congress that will insist that the people who testify before it tell the truth. The established record on Iran-Contra and in other respects establishes that Bobby Gates cannot be counted on to tell the truth.
In his autobiography, Lawrence Walsh, independent counsel in the Iran-Contra investigation from 1986 to 1993, wrote about Gates. "We did not believe that he could have forgotten a warning of North's diversion of the arms sales proceeds to the Contras. The mingling of two covert activities that were of intense personal interest to the president was not something the second highest officer in the CIA would forget." In letters delivered today to members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, nearly 700 individuals and organizations concerned with human rights asked the committee to reject Gates as Secretary of Defense. The letter states that Gates has been involved in violations of U.S. and international law that should make him ineligible to hold this office. Last week, Gates made comments indicating he is not in favor of leaving Iraq. Melvin Goodman.
I think there's a certain delicious irony here because Bob Gates is being sent in to clear up a situation caused by the misuse of intelligence. Let's face it, we got into war with lies about intelligence. So here is Gates, who is a master at manipulating intelligence. He proved that in the 1980s, now being sent to clean up a decision that was brought on by manufactured intelligence.
From Capitol Hill for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
The current time is 5:32, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We know what average Americans think of politicians, but what do politicians think of us? One clue is that numerous politicos are a little touchy about being touched by the masses. It turns out that many who make a living glad-handing really aren't even pleased about shaking our hands. Germs, you know. For example, at an October fundraiser in Topeka, the Republican faithful lined up to shake hands with a headliner, Dick Cheney. Before getting to the Veep, however, they had to get past a lady standing adjacent to Cheney with a big bottle of Purell, a hand sanitizer that promises to kill 99.99% of most common germs. To get their grip and grin with the honoree, each person first had to accept a squirt of the goop to purify their hands. Then, after the meet and greet was over, Cheney ducked backstage and rubbed a generous dollop of the antiseptic into his own hands, cleansing himself of the human contact he had just endured. The vice president is not alone in this act of political prissiness. "Good stuff," raved George W. as he touted the purifying qualities of Purell. Bill Clinton also is a user, as is Senator Barack Obama. And Senator John McCain says, "I use it all the time. I carry it with me in my briefcase." Not everyone believes in the shake and scrub routine, however. Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico bluntly says, "It's condescending to the voters." Richardson, who once shook a record 13,392 hands at the state fair without using a drop of Purell, adds that, "The great part about politics is that you're touching humanity." This is Jim Hightower saying, "I'm with Bill on this. During my own politicking period, my right hand often reeked of various colognes, barbecue sauce, and spilt beer. But to use a sanitizer seems to me like ballplayers using performance-enhancing steroids. If you're afraid of people's germs, find a new game."
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. Then at 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. The weather tonight is gray skies, occasional rain, and highs in the upper 30s this week in the Willamette Valley and Columbia Gorge. You're listening to KBOO News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
oil-rich Venezuela has re-elected Bush opponent President Hugo Chavez to another six-year term. Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
Supporters of both President Chavez and opposition candidate Manuel Rosales were out early and en masse yesterday. Some Chavez neighborhoods awoke by 3 a.m., launching fireworks and blasting music. By 4 a.m. in some areas, citizens had already begun to line up outside polling stations, which in most cases would not be open for at least another 3 hours. As a result, long lines reminiscent of Venezuela's 2004 recall referendum marked the morning with many citizens anxiously waiting long hours to cast their vote. Caracas resident Amalia Caña arrived at her polling place at 6 a.m. 3 hours later, she still had a good way to go.
As always, us Venezuelans are given an example. And look, you can see it here, standing in line in the sun, and here we are.
But by the afternoon, the lines had eased and people were able to cruise through the various stages of the polling places. Their fingerprints were checked in an electronic database to ensure they had not already voted. A finger was inked to ensure they could not vote again, and voters received a paper receipt of their electronic vote, which they cast into a ballot box. Despite minor problems, spirits were high and the day went smoothly across the country. The opposition, however, has a laundry list of complaints and alleged abnormalities, including claims that in opposition polling stations, votes for Rosales were changed to null. But Francisco Gutierrez, an Argentine congressional representative with an international observer team from Mercosur, says that the voting process couldn't have gone better.
In all of the polling places, we have spoken as much with the official party as with the witnesses of the opposition party. Everyone has said that it has been a clean, transparent, and democratic scenario. There was no inconvenience anywhere, so it is a democratic festival.
Polls closed after 4 p.m., and once everyone in line had had a chance to vote, Chavez's victory, with 61% of votes cast against Rosales's 38%, was announced at 10:30 p.m. last night by the National Electoral Council. Fireworks and celebration erupted from Caracas's poor neighborhoods. Chavez immediately addressed a crowd of thousands of supporters celebrating the pouring rain outside the presidential palace, Miraflores.
I want you to join me. Those who voted for me, the great majority, more than 60% of those who voted, voted for Chavez, for the homeland, for the new Bolivarian social project. It is the people who rule. I always rule following the orders of the Venezuelan people.
Shortly thereafter, Chavez's main rival, Manuel Rosales, recognized his defeat, erasing widespread fears that the opposition might attempt to delegitimize the results. Nevertheless, Rosales declared that Chavez's margin of victory was not as large as announced.
The results of the Electoral Council are not the exact difference. The margin of difference is smaller. But I'm going to continue in the streets, struggling for the people of Venezuela.
Chavez's victory gives the Venezuelan president 6 more years at the helm of this oil-rich country and adds renewed strength to his calls for socialism of the 21st century. In his next term, which Chavez has called the second phase of the Bolivarian Revolution, the Venezuelan president has promised to give more power to the people and set up a commission to study the democratic reform of the Venezuelan constitution. Chavez has suggested calling for a national referendum in 3 years to ask Venezuela's voters if they want to change the constitution to allow for indefinite re-elections of the president. Mike Fox, FSRN Caracas.
Earlier today, KBOO spoke with Venezuelan lawyer and writer Eva Golander, author of The Chavez Code and Bush v. Chavez, Washington's War Against Venezuela. She lives in Caracas and had this to say about the actual voting process and the Venezuelan people's sense of how well it worked.
It was an extraordinary, festive, and very joyful, peaceful day. Venezuelans came out in mass numbers. Long lines, but actually the process went very smooth with the election machine. No glitches at all, really. And it's overwhelming levels of calm and a festive type of environment. And we're looking at an abstention rate that, you know, is under 30%. Showing once again how actively Venezuelans participate in their government now under the Chavez administration, because 10 years ago, most Venezuelans didn't even have access to be able to exercise their vote, not access to voting centers or to voter registration. So this is what was classified by Chavez himself as a giant democratic active party is what took place here yesterday. No major incidents of violence, a few localized types of situations where primarily members of the opposition or, you know, little anti-Chavez groups tried to stir things up or cause chaos, but everything was pretty much controlled by the people themselves. In fact, what was even more amazing was because the lines were so long, in some cases, five blocks or more, people waiting in line. You know, here in Venezuela, we have a custom, well, just under the Chavez administration, but people celebrate so much the right to vote that people get up at 3 in the morning. They play a horn all over the city and throughout the country. People wake up at 3 in the morning, get ready, and go down to get in line to vote and to prepare the voting centers because they open at 6.
That was Eva Golanger speaking from Caracas, Venezuela.
The headquarters of Fiji's armed police has been seized by Fijian soldiers, raising fears of an imminent military coup. Soldiers also set up roadblocks around the capital, Suva. Military officials have accused Prime Minister Laysenia Karisse's government of corruption and has repeatedly threatened to overthrow it. The government refuses to step down.
Tony Blair announced today that to the British Parliament that he plans to renew the Trident submarine nuclear missile system. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Britain's nuclear system, Trident, consists of 200 operational nuclear warheads based on 4 nuclear submarines. The lifespan of the current Trident system ends in 2024, and renewing it is estimated to cost around $50 billion. The government claims an urgent decision is needed now. However, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, Sir Mingus Campbell, says a decision could be delayed until 2014.
There's no need to take the decision now. The lives of the existing boats and of the missile systems can be extended. We should fulfil our legal obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And if you remember, we are under obligation to seek to do everything in our power to try and achieve nuclear disarmament.
In what's being seen as a softener for members of Parliament opposing renewal of Trident, Tony Blair also proposed today to cut the operational nuclear warheads on Britain's Trident submarines from 200 to 160. It remains to be seen whether he'll garner enough votes in Parliament to pass his proposals through in February. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Chile's former dictator Augusto Pinochet remains hospitalized after suffering a heart attack yesterday. Jorge Garatón reports from Santiago.
The hospital said the 91-year-old dictator will remain hospitalized for at least 10 days. Outside the hospital, a throng of hardcore Pinochet supporters are holding a vigil praying he recovers. The government has refused to comment on the possibility of Pinochet's death. Human rights lawyers and family members of the detained and disappeared initially questioned Pinochet's heart attack, arguing the former dictator's attorneys always use his health as a defense tactic. The heart attack came just days after a fresh round of indictments. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Just 2 years after the tsunami devastated communities around the Indian Ocean, scientists say that another giant wave could strike off Sumatra within the next few decades. The December 26, 2004 tsunami that originated near Sumatra claimed nearly a 250,000 lives in 12 countries. Now researchers report that they have found evidence that wave-causing earthquakes have occurred in the region regularly, and parts of Sumatra could be threatened within 30 years. In addition to the USC study concluded researchers from the California Institute of Technology. Last week, the U.S. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration said that it and the government of Thailand launched a buoy station in the Indian Ocean to detect tsunamis.
The streets of South Africa's cities are crowded with life. Flower vendors and car guards, sex workers and traditional healers, street barber shops and cell phone repairs. But city governments see this life as a problem, an obstacle to creating world-class cities with smooth traffic flows and no signs of any social problems. Tierna Giuse reports on the growing resistance of street traders to efforts to clear them from the streets.
I'm actually a sex worker that works on the street.
Kim has lived on the streets of Cape Town for 5 years. Like many others, she is constantly harassed.
The police come along, they pick me up, throw me into a holding cell. If they pick me up on a Friday, I stay there the whole weekend without even seeing a judge. I get released the Monday, and I never even got to see a judge.
Everyone who lives or works in South Africa's urban public space faces some level of harassment. Despite the fact that this informal sector employs between 30 and 40% of the South African workforce, across the country, city bylaws and enforcement seem designed to force these activities out of the best locations in wealthy areas. The poor, it seems, must only make money from the poor. Many tensions arise from competition for the best locations. Pat Mpanza is a traditional healer who resents immigrant street traders.
Well, after the 1994 elections, there was a plan of flea market places which were built in our country. But at the end of the day, those flea market places are also, most of them are occupied by the immigrants.
Her xenophobia is not uncommon. Scores of Somali traders were assaulted or murdered in Cape Town this year, to take just one violent example. But where street traders are organized, the view is different. Fundile Jalile is the president of the African Hawkers Association in Mtata, Eastern Cape.
No one has got the right to attack any member. Now, even if now you are a foreigner, so-called, if you're a member of the African Hawkers Association, you are secured, because if now the South Africans are attacking you, we are going to charge that person because you are saying the name of our organization is African Workers Association. That African alone accommodates every people of Africa.
In Tata, a majority of street traders are part of the association, and they now successfully resist and negotiate with the municipality and the police to defend their place in the street. Mtata is one of South Africa's smaller urban areas where there's adequate space for traders, so it has been easier to organize diverse groups there into a united association. This task is more difficult in the bigger cities where competition and division is greater. Livingston Matanga with the South African National Traders Alliance in Joburg says that city governments are misguided.
All what they are now implementing is unconstitutional, because nobody has been told, the stakeholders and the people who are in the ground, they were not knowing. So all the policies that of the government is policies that have been drafted by consultants.
StreetNet, a worldwide organization of street traders, has proposed a common set of demands that vendors can unite behind. StreetNet director Pat Horn says street traders are not dead set against any changes.
Then we want them to undertake that any relocation of street vendors, informal market vendors or hawkers, must include viable and acceptable alternatives which are accessible to even the poorest traders, including women and traders with disabilities.
Ahead of the World Cup, StreetNet and its affiliates are calling on groups ranging from municipal unions to child welfare advocates and even the South African Football Association itself to work together towards world-class cities for all. This campaign aims to put those who will be most affected by new development at the center of the planning process. This effort is vital if the hosting of the World Cup is to benefit the most vulnerable South Africans. This is Teena Guse, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The Indonesian energy firm Lapindo Brantas has agreed to demands by locals to pay more compensation following an oil well accident. Entire villages were inundated by hot mud following the accident at the exploratory oil well. Around 10,000 people in the region were displaced. Following protests, a firm will pay up to $273 per square meter for damaged lands. They had previously offered only about $33 a month.
In Haiti, a prominent member of the tiny elite is on the verge of clinching a seat in the Senate. Rudolph Boulos has gone from hobnobbing with U.S. policymakers in Washington, D.C., to slapping peasants on the back in dusty villages north of northeastern Haiti. But he faces charges of involuntary homicide, and his opponents accuse him of lying about his citizenship. Reed Lindsay has more from Haiti.
Rudolph Boulos is an unlikely populist. He's a wealthy industrialist and a prominent member of Haiti's tiny, light-skinned elite in a country that is overwhelmingly poor and black. He extols free market economics and boasts of his close links with U.S. politicians. But in this hardscrabble province that borders the Dominican Republic, Boulos attracts large crowds of peasants and workers with rousing speeches and free food. During 2 years of campaigning, Boulos has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money, giving away everything from notebooks to television sets. Pierre Jackson is a construction worker and Boulos supporter.
We've already seen what he can do. He's fixed 88 water pumps. He's repaired roads. He's helped peasants with their banana plantations. He's given away trees. That's proof that he will do even more as a senator.
But Boulos' candidacy is not without controversy. His opponents accuse him of buying a Senate seat and the immunity that comes with it. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court ordered that Bulos be tried for involuntary homicide for his responsibility in the deaths of more than 90 children from an adulterated medicine produced by his company, Farval Laboratories. The case has dragged on for 10 years, and a judge who would oversee the trial has not been assigned since the Supreme Court ruling more than 6 months ago. Bertoni Philippe is spokesman for an organization representing the family members of the victims.
This is a prestigious family, a family that has money, a family that has more power than the state itself. That is why Bulos is not in jail, and this case is not going anywhere.
Bulos admits his company's responsibility, but insists the case ended after he paid 70 victims $10,000 each in compensation.
Why should I sue against immunity? Immunity against what? It's Farval that's implicated. It's not Rudolf Bulos.
According to the victim's lawyer, the families accepted money from Bulos, but he could still be found guilty on criminal charges. The maximum sentence is 1 year in prison. Bulos is co-founder of the Haitian Democracy Project, a Washington, D.C. think tank whose board of directors boasts a former U.S. ambassador and special envoy to Haiti. In campaign speeches, he promises to use his contacts with diplomats and U.S. politicians to obtain foreign funding for development projects. Bulos donated $5,000 to United States political campaigns in 2001 and 2002. The recipients include Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel of New York. This has led some critics to question his Haitian citizenship. It is illegal to donate money to political candidates in the United States unless you are a U.S. citizen or resident. If Bulos were either at the time of the donations, his candidacy would be disqualified. The Haitian Constitution prohibits dual citizenship and requires candidates to reside in the country 4 years before an election. Bulos denies ever being a U.S. citizen or resident.
No, because I've really traveled to the U.S. I've never lived in the U.S. I've lived all my life here in Haiti. And when I could not, I went to the DR next door so I could smell the odor of Haiti.
Max Mazarin is the president of Haiti's Electoral Council. He said Bulos presented the required documents, but he admitted that no investigation was conducted.
Unless somebody brings the evidence to us, we can't go looking for it. We'd have to do so for every candidate. But where is the money? The Electoral Council doesn't have the money to do this type of research.
Bulos has never lived in the northeastern province, but his blue blood, white skin, and controversial past do not seem to bother the voters. The results are not yet known, but he was expected to win easily in Sunday's election. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Reed Lindsay from Wanamet, Haiti.
An Indian judge has finished delivering verdicts on 123 defendants charged in India's worst terror attack. The latest guilty verdicts bring the total number of convicted in the 1993 Mumbai bombings to 100. The blast killed more than 250 people and injured 700. The attacks are believed to have been an act of retaliation after a Hindu nationalist destroyed a mosque in 1992.
In the East Indian state of Bengal, agitation over a planned automobile factory turned violent today when a Maoist organization ransacked a car showroom following a government expropriation of land from thousands of farmers. Vinod Kejos reports.
India's largest private sector conglomerate, Tata, wants to build a car manufacturing unit 20 miles from the East Indian city of Kolkata. The government expropriated over 1,000 acres of farmland for the private corporation in the name of public interest. 10,000 poor farmers have been ordered off their land in return for a meager compensation. Maoists armed with rods, sticks and stones today responded to this weekend's forceful eviction of farmers by smashing Tata's auto showroom in the heart of Kolkata city. At least 5,000 armed police and paramilitary forces took possession of the land over the weekend. With the protection of security forces, the government said the land should be completely fenced off by tomorrow. For FSRN, from New Delhi, this is Vinod Kejos.
Around 2,000 people in Niger have staged a protest against plans to ratify a bill on women's rights. Africa's Maputo Protocol aims to guarantee equal rights in such areas as marriage, politics, and employment. Niger's government approved the protocol back in January, but the parliament voted against it. 95% of Niger's population is Muslim, and protesters say the protocol contradicts traditional Islamic law.
The United Nations and World Bank have signed a $4 million deal to help Liberia rebuild three major roads. It's hoped they will open up trade and create work for almost 5,000 Liberians. Liberia's infrastructure was seriously damaged by 14 years of civil war, which ended in 2003.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 4th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mike Monkbold. Our wire editors are Brendan Wright and Prentice Darden. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Trillian Shannon, Chris Andre, Martha Odom, Kathleen Stevenson, and Mike Monkvold. Our engineer is Jeff Lovell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. First, we'd like to extend some congratulations to KBOO volunteer DeMay Roberts. She's one of the first 50 U.S. artists to win a $50,000 grant from United States Artists, or USA, a new organization dedicated to the support of America's finest living artists. The winners were announced today in New York, where DeMay received a hug of congratulations from actor Danny Glover. Another Oregon artist receiving one of the grants today was cartoonist and journalist Joe Sacco. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg speaks with Jed Rubenfeld, author of The Interpretation of Murder, a historical mystery set in New York in 1909. It features Sigmund Freud. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with focus on black authors. At 10, Marianne Barisonek interviews Dorothy Mackey, founder of Survivors Taking Action Against Abusers of Military Personnel, and Sarah Rich, mother of Suzanne Swift, who was sexually abused while serving in the Army. They'll discuss the upcoming conference on human rights abuses in the military. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, hear about The Road to Closure, a film about the Khmer tribunals in Cambodia, and Imago Theater's Big Little Things. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our humble news broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. And thanks for joining us.
Publisher of the Portland Alliance invites you to celebrate 25 years of non-corporate community publishing. On Saturday, December 9th, you are invited to a fundraiser, dinner, auction, and celebration of the Portland Alliance. Events will include a silent auction featuring local quilts, art, and other artifacts of interest, dinner and music by General Strike, and a special musical roast of the Mainstream Press by Melinda Pittman, founder of the Fallen Angel Choir. Enjoy an evening of food, friends, and music while supporting your independent media news, the Portland Alliance. This event will be held at St. Andrew Catholic Church Community Center, 806 Northeast Alberta Avenue in Portland. Advance tickets may be purchased by calling 503-239-4991 or by logging on to www.theportlandalliance.org. That's Saturday, December 9th, beginning at 6 p.m. KBOO is proud to co-sponsor this event.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio, the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, Teamsters Local 206. Tis the season. In just a few short weeks, many of us will be with our families or friends opening all those gifts piled high under the Christmas tree. Xboxes, plasma TVs, navigation systems, laptops, and other hot items for the 2006 season. Yet, to a growing number of Oregonians, Christmas is just another day and another struggle to put food on the table. A recent survey by the Oregon Food Bank revealed that nearly one-third of all food box recipients needed help because their wages are too low. 47% of food box recipients had at least one adult working in the family, and 30% of those working full-time. 78% reported incomes less than the federal poverty line, and one-third of those recipients are under one-half of the federal poverty line. Who are the hungry, and what are the barriers to employment for Oregonians? And more importantly, how can we help this holiday season? Later on tonight's program, we'll be talking about D10 and human rights in Central America, and also with Orion Lumiere about Sisters of the Road, a very interesting nonprofit. But first on Labor Radio is Rachel Bristol, Executive Director of the Oregon Food Bank. Rachel, welcome back to Labor Radio.
Thanks, Bill.
And congratulations on recently being selected as Oregon's most admired nonprofit.
Thank you.
Must be a great tribute to the hard work that you and your staff do.
Tribute to the staff, our board, but also the community that supports us.
So, Rachel, tell us a little bit. I mean, I would imagine you have to be from another planet not to know about Oregon Food Bank, but tell us a little bit about Oregon Food Bank.
We're the hub of a statewide network. Actually, we serve every county in Oregon as well as Clark County, Washington. We directly operate the regional food banks serving the four-county metro area, as well as in the last couple of years, we've taken on responsibility for the regional food banks in southeastern Oregon as well as Tillamook County. In other areas of the state, we work with independent nonprofits, regional food banks. We deliver food to them every week in our big rigs, and they in turn get it out to a network of direct service agencies. About 350 of those are directly served by Oregon Food Bank, and about 500 more are served by the other regional food banks throughout the state.
So this is quite a distribution center you have set up.
That's right.
And it wasn't always quite this way, was it?
No.
I remember the old days down on Williams Avenue.
Things have changed at the food bank. In fact, we're just about coming up on our fifth anniversary of being in the new facility out on 33rd Drive, and the timing couldn't have been better in terms of that facility and being able to deal with double-digit increases that we saw over the last 5 years.
So now, and how big is that warehouse? How many trucks? How many workers? Who are the workers?
It's a 108,000 square foot facility. We have a total of 100 staff now. Again, those are about 65 or so working out of the Riverside facility, managing 15,000 volunteers who are helping us in repacking food every day. And then we've got about 12 drivers on the road every day picking up donations of food and then distributing it back out to our network.
So where does some of this food come from?
The majority comes from Oregon's food industry. Unfortunately, over the last decade and really last 20 years, we've lost a lot of food processors here in Oregon. And so it's getting more and more challenging to keep the food supply up. One of our newer resources is through a program we started about 3 years ago called Fresh Alliance, where we're sending out smaller refrigerated trucks picking up fresh dairy and frozen meat from our major retailers on a daily basis. That's putting another 5 million pounds of high-quality food into the system that simply hasn't been there in the past.
I know that, this is quite a few years ago, I picked up a load of oranges and grapefruit in Foodlink in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
And I, quite honestly, I was a little disappointed because I was expecting boxed food of something or other, and they put all these grapefruits and oranges on. I was almost embarrassed to deliver it, and I still can remember the day I got there. Everybody was so excited that you had something fresh.
That's right, yeah. Years ago, we moved a lot of things that are available in large quantities here in Oregon, like potatoes and onions. We get a lot of apples out of Washington State. We've actually got a new program started with farmers in eastern Oregon that are doing planned production for us. We have grown more reliant on food drives and financial contributions to purchase food. Each of those sources is now about 15% each. Federal commodities are still just on this roller coaster, unfortunately, have dropped 25% each of the last 2 years.
So the main idea behind Oregon Food Bank is to provide food boxes for hungry people. I mean,
well, we have a two-part mission, really. Okay. First is dealing with hunger in the immediate, and that is by keeping good food out of the landfill and putting that to use throughout the state in an equitable fashion. So if someone's hungry, if they live in Coos Bay or Ontario or Portland, they're going to get a similar mix of food. Mm-hmm. But the second part of our mission is really about working on the underlying causes of hunger. And we do that through a number of ways, from working on public policy at the state, local, and federal levels, advocating with things like the Farm Bill to retain programs like food stamps, USDA commodities. We also work on issues like minimum wage. Sometimes some of our donors are not terribly happy with how out front we get about that, but one of the things we've been seeing in our Hunger Factors survey that we do every other year is a continuing increase in the number of working poor.
Right.
And I think we all know that we've lost all those timber mills and much of the manufacturing that used to happen in Oregon, including food processors, and the jobs that have replaced them tend to be service sector.
Right, and I think that's something that, you know, sometimes some people want to stereotype, I guess you want to say, hungry people as freeloaders or, you know, something other than what it really is. But that's not really the case. And, I mean, I imagine there is some of that. I would not...
Well, I think there's always going to be a few among us who are going to leech off the majority, but they aren't necessarily necessarily poor. They can come in all stripes and incomes.
Right.
But that really is the exception rather than the rule.
And again,
we hear, if it wasn't for my kids, I couldn't have come in and asked for this food. My kids haven't eaten anything but popcorn for 3 days. That's when the parents show up. In our society, even though we have institutionalized charity for a growing number of our people to put food on the table in this country, it's still, we all get the same messages. You're supposed to be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Right.
And so it's particularly demoralizing for folks who are working.
Right, and sometimes, you are working, and sometimes you just can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps this week or this day.
That's right.
Or this month.
Little emergency extra expense is the thing that tips the scales.
I think that's kind of the connection for me is, it used to be in this country, and you brought it up earlier, there were manufacturing jobs or food processing jobs, and you didn't have to be a rocket scientist or a college graduate to go and get a job to make a decent wage, to have some kind of a pension and health care.
That's right.
And put food on the table. Those jobs are now gone.
They're gone, and now we're seeing health care taken away from more and more employers as the costs are skyrocketing.
And I got to imagine that today's cost of housing and fuel
absolutely
must, just wreak havoc on a minimum wage family.
Oh, absolutely. In the more rural areas of the state, people are not able to make the trip in to where the food pantry is.
Mm-hmm.
And some places you get in central Oregon, and when we talk to emergency food clients out there, it's kind of a losing game. They're being forced out of the city because of growing tourism and retirement communities growing there, and they're having to live 25 miles away from where the jobs are. And when fuel's going up 10 cents a week, those dollars are just getting stretched further and further.
Are there any numbers on the number of hungry people in this state?
It averages just under 200,000 people a month who eat out of emergency food boxes. On average, the same household only receives 3 to 4 food boxes in a year. And that's
so this isn't something somebody keeps coming back week after week after week.
Right. I mean, there are, in Portland, frankly, there are a lot of programs, and so a person can go from one program to another, although we work with the agency, so they have defined service areas by zip codes, so nobody, is taking all of the need, but that need is kind of shared. But for the most part, when you get outside of downtown Portland proper, even 10 miles out, there simply aren't the agencies and the food there for people to rely on it more frequently.
Out of that number of hungry, how many are children?
About 40%, just under 40%.
And you said earlier, and again, it can't. I'm sure there are some people out there who want to go to a food bank and get a free box of food. Well, okay, good for you. But this can't be an easy thing for a parent or an adult to do.
No, you really have to set aside your pride to ask for the most basic, to put food on the table. There's still people who are diving into dumpsters and doing whatever they can to scrounge for their own, and even though food safety issues are, a growing issue.
Yeah, and that's just hard to believe in 2006.
Yeah.
We're still, you would hope that somewhere along the line, and I hate to say this, but, you would be out of business, okay?
Well, that's what I thought when I started this work almost 24 years ago, but it's certainly gone in the other direction. We do have some good news. The recent USDA survey came out where they average surveys over a 3-year period, and now instead of being in the top 10, we're tied for 22nd most hungry in the nation. That's, we're cautiously optimistic. Part of that is things have gotten worse in some other states. We haven't seen a statistically significant decline in the demand here. And frankly, our, as I mentioned earlier, we're really struggling to keep the volume of food up. Last year, our food distribution dropped by about 3 million pounds. So we have been doing a lot of work, a lot of outreach to get people who are eligible signed up for food stamps, but many households only qualify for $10 or $20 a month.
Right.
So, you know, we're hopeful that we are seeing a leveling off, but given the drop in the food supply, we're not real sure how much of that is a reflection of the limits of the food available versus a true softening in terms of the need.
So what does a food box look like? If someone comes in, what could they expect out of a food box?
Well, today the agencies do the best job they can to provide a nutritionally balanced 3 to 5 day supply of food for based on the family size that they're serving. So it will have some canned vegetables, some soup, thanks to our retail partners. It'll have some frozen meat in it, hopefully some fresh milk. Along with fresh produce, we're bringing a lot of fresh produce in from California, Arizona, in addition to what we grow here in the Northwest. And then it's a real mix of whatever's been donated
in that
month. You know, one month it may be a lot of soy products, and the next month it may be a lot of frozen green beans. We kind of have waves of supplies of different items. So we try to do some filling in with food purchases to get some of those items that aren't donated in large quantities.
So this food box is meant just to kind of help out for a few days until somebody can get back on their feet. So once you get your food box, I mean, if you're not employed, is there any assistance in helping? I guess what I really want to ask is, what are some of the barriers for people that come in and ask for food boxes? What are some of the barriers for them seeking employment?
Well, about a third of them don't have any phones.
Okay.
About a third don't have any form of transportation. And once again, you get outside the city limits very far, and public transportation is few and far between in most communities in Oregon. But when we look at that adult population, Bill, remember 57% of the households have at least one adult working. So who are the rest of the adults? They're retired.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, we're seeing a growing need among the senior population who are trying to live on limited Social Security benefits, taxes going up. They're disabled and may get very minimal disability benefits, like $300 a month.
Which is now just enough to pay for gasoline, probably.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And more and more, people are also... One spouse is staying home to take care of a disabled spouse or grandmother or son, etc. So people that are just really stretched to the max, those who are employable are actively looking for work. Many of them are kind of filling the gap with temporary employment, part-time, maybe patching together two part-time jobs.
Right.
They don't have any health benefits, so if they get sick, they end up in our emergency rooms.
But again, the number of jobs, and I mean, a lot of this I go back to, you know, politicians and free trade agreement and either party. I'm not, you know, take your pick. I'm not particular on that issue. You know, and all these manufacturing jobs move overseas and offshore, and the jobs that most of us can do, because, again, we're not all rocket scientists.
Right.
We're not all college educated. We're not all this or that. You know, some of us just want to go and make a widget, you know, 8 hours a day for the rest of our life and be happy doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Those jobs are not out there.
That's right.
And it's not just this state. I mean, it's across the United States.
No, yes, it's a phenomenon throughout the U.S. And
where do we go?
I mean,
where
even we look at our farmers and the competition they have from food coming in through other countries. I think we have an unreasonable expectation in this country about how cheap things should be. And if we want to have a society and an economy that will allow people to go out and buy their own groceries, then we're going to have to look at paying for those things that are our basic needs, like food, paying farmers what it really costs to pay workers a wage that they can live on to grow and harvest that food.
Right. I mean, you know, what are we asking for? A tank of gas in our old car, you know, a roof that doesn't leak.
Right.
And food on the table.
Right.
And I thought this
and
was...
And hopefully some heat during the winter.
Exactly. So Rachel, tell me, and the reason I invited John here is because it is the season, and a lot of people are in the giving mood, and that's what I'm hoping they're going to do after this program is start giving. And how can people give, and what can they give?
Cash goes a long ways. For every dollar donated, we can collect and distribute about $6 worth of food. We can move about enough to fill one emergency food box for $10. So your dollar stretches a long way. It keeps fuel in our trucks and keeps our lights and freezers on so that we can continue to distribute to this network of nearly 900 agencies. Of course, you can always make direct food donations. There's a number of drives going on right now. Jiffy Lube and Albertsons, U.S. Bank have all teamed up for places where you can drop off food donations. You can, of course, give us a call and drop off food at our warehouse, or we'll refer you to one of our member agencies that may be closer by, and you can drop it off at their offices.
So I could go right to Albertsons, buy $25, $30, $40 worth of food, and just walk right over to a barrel and dump it in a barrel?
That's right.
Well, that's pretty easy, don't you think? What's the website real quick in case somebody
wants to... It's real easy, www.oregonfoodbank.org. That didn't come out right. O-R-G.
And then if someone needs help or wants to help, how about volunteers? Can you use volunteers?
We are booked through holiday.
Cool.
But we are in desperate need of volunteers the week of Christmas and the first, you know, the end of December, 1st of January.
And the rest of the year.
You're right. And, we really do rely on about 3,500 volunteers each month to do what we do, and as we're repacking a lot more of the food now, comes to us in a bulk form. We've got to bag it up, put labels on it to get it in a form that our agencies and their clients can use.
So again, folks, go to Albertsons, buy some food, drop it right off at the store. You can go to Jiffy Lube and drop it off. You don't even have to have your oil changed. Or U.S. Bank, you said, can you drop it off?
U.S. Bank, check out our website. There are a number of suggestions of ways that you can contribute. You'll learn a lot more about the issue and about Oregon Food Bank and our network.
Well, Rachel Bristol, Executive Director of Oregon Food Bank, I really appreciate you taking it. I know this is really a busy time for you, and I really appreciate you coming down here. Come on, folks, just go buy a gift certificate or, I don't know, some canned food, drop it in the barrel so that other people can have a pretty decent Christmas day.
Thanks, Bill.
So we're not buying a week's worth of groceries here. We're just talking about a couple of days.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Rachel, thank you very much. I appreciate you
coming in.
You have a good time. And also in the studio tonight, we have Orion Numier. I knew I was going to say that wrong, didn't I?
Huh. You were really close.
Yeah.
I just got married. My new last name is Lumiere.
Lumiere. I can't even read my own writing. That's my problem. And friend. Tell us a little bit about your friend.
Well, this is a little guy. I'm going to give a pseudonym to protect the innocent. We'll call him Kay. And he's one of my customer's dogs at Sisters of the Road. And my customer is going into detox to get cleaned up and asked me to take care of Kay.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Sisters of the Road.
Well, Sisters of the Road is down in Old Town Chinatown. It's been there since 1979, where we were founded to provide people a place to work for their food, a safe place for women and children, and a place where people could get a nutritious hot meal using their food stamps or working for their food or paying $1.50.
So unlike the food bank, you can come in and get a good hot meal, is that...
Right. Instead of just picking up canned goods or boxes of food, you can actually get a plate.
So I envision volunteers coming into this already if you're preparing hot food.
Yes. Actually, most of the jobs you'll see if you come into our cafe are done by volunteers or barter workers. So we're always looking for people to work.
Okay. Barter workers. Explain that.
Barter workers. So they're bartering their labor for food. So if you work at Sisters for 15 minutes, you've earned enough for a meal and a drink. And people really love that.
Oh, wow.
instead of a handout kind of situation.
Exactly. So I could come down here, work a few hours, and get a coupon or something and get a free meal later on? Is that...
Well, we can give you coupons, or we can put your name on our books.
Uh-huh.
So we have records of people going back, you know, 10, 15, 20 years even. If you pass in and out of Portland, if you've worked for us, we'll keep a record of it, and you can always use that credit.
Oh, wow. So how many people are, how many volunteers are on staff at any given time?
We have about 200 volunteers that circulate throughout the year. Some of them regularly, once a week. Some of them a little less regularly. Some people come almost every day. And then there are barter workers who work for us every day. And then they'll, something will happen in their lives and we won't see them for a few months, but they usually come back. It's kind of like a living room. Like,
okay.
People know, we know their names, we know their stories. It's about building relationship at Sisters. So
it's a safe place to be.
It's a safe place to be, and it's a homey place to be.
Okay. So with all these volunteers and all this work, what does a meal look like? I mean, what can you expect to go in? You say 15 minutes. That's a pretty good deal, 15 minutes for a free meal.
It's a really good deal.
So what does a meal look like?
Well, every day we have a vegetarian option. We have beans and rice and cornbread, which we've had since we opened. And our salsa's kicking, I have to tell you. And then in addition to that, we have a different entree every day. And often we have a vegetarian and meat version. So you could get meat spaghetti or veggie spaghetti or rice and bean and cornbread. Every day, plus cold cereal, boiled eggs, that kind of side dishes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you have to work for this.
Yes, you do.
I kind of like that. Now, could I just come in and do dishes? Or?
Yeah, you could, absolutely. And actually, dishwashing is the one job that you get a little more credit for, because it's kind of the hardest job, if you think about it. There are exceptions for the handout, and that is if you are a single parent and you can't work because you've got your kids to watch while you're
mm-hmm,
eating,
mm-hmm.
We keep credit that other customers have donated, and we will give you a free meal off of that account.
Yep.
And that also applies to people who are too elderly or disabled to work. Other customers have donated their labor towards a special account that we feed other people off of. And also, the first time you come to Sisters, you eat for free. On us as a measure of hospitality to say welcome. And all of those meals have been donated by customers, too.
Hmm. So is that where you get most of your food at, is donations or...?
We actually, the lady from the food bank, I wanted to shake her hand and say thank you, because we get a lot of food from the food bank.
Uh-huh.
Other food we have to buy, so that we always need cash donations. And then other food sometimes we get donated.
See, I kind of like this idea, and I saw that barter in here under one of the I went up to the website and saw that barter piece, and I was kind of wondering about that. I thought, well, okay, maybe I have to go fix a roof and then come back and get a meal. But this is all contained right within the Sisters of the Road. And it's where again?
It's at 133 Northwest 6th Avenue, right on the bus mall.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people do office work, too, by way of barter. And then other times, yeah, if we moved offices in the summer and all those guys were barter workers. They schlepped a lot of furniture next door, and we gave them a barter credit, so... Just all kinds of stuff, taking out the trash. And
so there's a lot of jobs, and you don't certainly need to barter for a meal. If you just want to volunteer through the season to kind of get into the season, you could just come down and do volunteer some of your time or experience doing some of the jobs.
That's right. Anyone can volunteer at any time of the year.
Okay.
So we're open all year round, Monday through Friday, and we always need volunteers.
Okay, one of the things I noticed on your website was this, I'm sorry, I didn't announce you were an assistant in the development program?
That's right, I work in development there.
Okay, and what is the workforce development?
Workforce development is a program by which when we have a job opening come open, we try to hire our customers first. And this especially works out in a cafe. So we have a temporary labor pool where our customers work part-time for us or fill in when
mm-hmm.
staff are
mm-hmm.
sick. And then when we have like a cook or a dishwasher or a cashier or kitchen manager even, like whatever comes open, we try to hire from our customers first.
Okay, did I miss something here? Is there an actual cafe that's open to the public?
Oh, yes.
Okay, I missed that piece. I knew there was something here that I wasn't getting
around
to.
Yeah, it's a real cafe open to the public. Anyone can eat there.
Okay, is that where Doris's Cafe came in years ago? Was that any part of that? Or?
Well, Rosie Dean.
Right, I worked with Rosie.
Yes. She's the famous cook from Doris, and she came in and volunteered over Thanksgiving for our soul food meal and barbecued some amazing ribs and chicken and cooked collard
sweet
greens.
Sweet potatoes.
Yes. And anyone can come in and eat. So it wasn't just, you know, homeless and low-income folks. Like, some of my friends came down. My brother came down. It was good food.
So this is an actual cafe. People come and go and eat and pay money.
Yes,
and
they do.
Some people just have to come and work and get food.
That's very interesting. They like to, actually, and they can only have $50 worth of credit, so they can take coupons with them for credit. But even after they're totally maxed out of credit, they like to come in and have a place where they can be useful and do something useful, not be on the streets, not be tempted by drugs or alcohol, a place where they can stay clean, get away from the drama, and do something meaningful. Gives their life purpose. They get upset when they can't work. If I tell them, there's no jobs today, everyone's working already. Oh, no, I have to do something. I want to help.
So outside of coming down and actually physically cooking a meal or washing dishes, I don't think you'll ever see me there doing dishes.
Not a dishwasher.
No.
It's a special breed.
Yeah, thank you. I may come down, and I'm pretty good on hotcakes. That I can do. I may come down and do that. And barbecues, do you have a barbecue down there?
We don't.
Oh, good.
That's
I'm
where
safe
we brought. We had to get Rosie in to hook us up.
Those are good ribs. Besides coming down and doing dishes, there's like sweeping floors and wiping tables and bussing and all that kind of thing.
Serving the food.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The plates.
What other Okay, I'm not really into volunteering, let's just say. What else could I do?
Well, we give hygiene supplies to our customers. That's one of our services. So you could do a hygiene drive in your church or your workplace or your office. And collect toothpaste, razors, socks, things for people who need them, feminine hygiene supplies and diapers we need. We have a lot of low-income and homeless parents and children, so we always need diapers. And you could collect them and bring them to sisters in November and December especially. We're collecting as many as we can.
Okay. So is there a website? And, I mean, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but you brought up this donation, and I know there's some great souls out there that are saying, you know what, I'm going to go back to my whatever my organization is, and we're going to bring down some supplies in the next couple of weeks, because I can imagine you need a lot of this around Christmas time.
We do. We have a great need. And you can check sistersoftheroad.org. There's a page, Ways to Give, where you can find a link for a whole list of all the things we need. Okay. And if you log on there, you'll see that also for cash donations.
I was just going to ask you, how's that work?
Yeah, November and December. Well, it's really cool. The foundation, the Collins Foundation, gave us a grant that will match all new donors who have never donated to Sisters 1-to-1.
Whoa, so if somebody donates $100, they'll donate $100?
Exactly.
Oh, wow. So give that website again. Come on, folks.
www.sistersoftheroad.org. And the catch is, if we don't get $20,000 worth of new donations, we don't get the Collins match.
Oh, wow.
And in addition to that, though, we have a pool that matches everybody, no matter who they are, 50 cents on the dollar. So everyone will be matched.
So, again, this is, see, and I knew there was a connection here somewhere, but I wasn't quite clear about it. This is an actual up-and-running cafe who serves meals just like any normal cafe. But on the side, you're helping people in what could be apparently a rough time in life and trying to get them stabilized. Are there any programs to help people, you know, with problems, whatever type of problems they have? I mean, what else?
Programs within Sisters?
Yes.
I'd say the Workforce Development Program and the BARTA Program are our main programs for that. We also have a Systemic Change Program, so we're not content to just help out people and work with people who are homeless. We want to know why people are homeless.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a Systemic Change Program that is involved in a lot of different things around town, like the Mayor's Visioning Project. We give testimony at City Hall. Right now we're organizing among people.
Yeah, I knew there was something
with
else
homelessness.
Going on.
Yeah, we want to work ourselves out of a job and then just be the best damn coffee house in Portland. That's our our goal.
You want to do the address again one more time?
Sure. It's 133 Northwest 6th Avenue, Portland, 97209. And the website, sistersoftheroad, all one word, .org.
So what's the lunch special like? I mean,
the lunch special?
Yeah, I mean,
well,
I'll tell you,
Friday's the best day.
Okay.
It's Mexican day.
Oh, really?
We have really good burritos, and we have really good veggie burritos and meat burritos. Fridays, my husband packs me lunch a lot of days, and I say, don't bother on Friday, honey, because
okay.
I want to eat at Sisters.
So what kind of price are we talking? What, you know, just public? What do we walk in?
$1.50.
Everybody's $1.50?
Everybody for a meal and a drink is $1.50. So you can get a nice burrito and a cup of hot coffee with free refills for $1.50.
But what if you wanted to pay like $2.50?
Well, then the extra dollar would be a donation.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear.
We have meal coupons, too, I should tell you.
Okay.
If you are, you know, when you get panhandled downtown and you would like to know that your donation is going to something you support, we sell meal coupons. So for $2, you can buy them at Sisters, and then you can give them to panhandlers, and they can come in and eat at Sisters.
So I'm getting on the freeway, and I see some guy with a sign that says I'm homeless, and I really want to help him out. And you really feel bad, but sometimes you wonder, and there's a stereotype out there. And who am I to judge, is what I always say. But I could come down to the Sisters of the Road Cafe. I could buy a handful of meal coupons, mm-hmm. and I can hand it to them, knowing that my money went to feed this person.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And we can even, you can order them over the phone or with a credit card online, and we can mail them to you to make it easy.
Oh, well.
But yeah, exactly. So you know where your money's going, and you know that that person will be treated with respect and hospitality when they get to Sisters, because we're not a soup kitchen. That we are a cafe. So that person will be able to sit down in an atmosphere of respect and dignity and be served a meal in a really safe atmosphere.
I think that's the part I really like, is that it's not a soup line or a, you know, or what you would think of a homeless shelter feeding people. I mean, when you walk into here, and again, I think just to be able to mingle with society is an improvement in some lives.
Well, crossing class lines is important to all of us.
Right.
So it's important to me when I sit down at Sisters that I can, as a middle class person, carry on a conversation with someone from another class. And we both learn something. If we don't start crossing class lines, I mean, you always talk about on your show how we're being divided up by the powers that be, you know, middle class against lower class and different income levels. It's just we have to stick together, and we're not going to be able to do that unless we get to know each other.
Okay.
So
one more time, let's do the phone number and the website. And
yeah, the phone number is 503-222-5694.
And I can call up and get 50 meal tickets and pay, be $100, and you would mail them to me, and then I could drive up on the freeway when I see these people and just say, here, take some of these and go get a decent hot meal.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you make a
now
cash
that's the Christmas spirit. That's what I'm looking for.
And if you make a cash donation and you're a new donor, you will get matched by the Collins Foundation. So that's a good thing to remember, too.
And the website was?
Sistersoftheroad.org. And I'm the webmistress. So when you log on there, tell me what you think, y'all. I want to know if you like my website.
You do web pages?
I sure do.
Oh, okay.
We need to talk.
First of the year, we need to talk. I do have a project I'm working on. How can I barter that? Or no, wait a minute. You're working for me. We'll work something out on that.
We'll give you meal coupons.
So, Orion Lumiere, Assistant Development Coordinator at Sisters of the Road, I really appreciate you coming in and talking about this. And come on, folks. I thought this was a very interesting nonprofit. And I knew there was a connection in there I really wasn't getting, and I didn't know there was an actually up-and-running cafe. That's the part I missed, okay?
Come on in and have lunch with me.
Well, I am now.
Okay.
I didn't know this part, so I will be doing that. Are you open on the weekend at all?
No, we're open from Monday through Friday from 10 to 3.
Okay, very good.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ryan, I appreciate you and Kay coming in and talking to us. And very nice pup. I haven't heard a sound out of him.
No, he's a good boy.
Okay.
I hope his dad comes back to us.
Okay. Well, folks, here's something you can do to help out someone else's holiday season, and I'd really appreciate it. And again, Ryan, thank you for coming in. And
thanks for having me, Bill.
No problem. My pleasure. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be having a phone call about an event coming up called D10. And right now, Ben, if you'd like to do the last piece of underwriting, I'd appreciate it.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.
And welcome back to Labor Radio. And if you just joined us, it's way past 6:30, and this is KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman. You're listening to Labor Radio.
And in the studio tonight, we have Stephen Toff of the Associated Western Pulp and Paper Workers. He's an organizing coordinator. And Daniel Bonham. And you're also an organizer? Is that what I'm seeing here?
Or? No, I'm the executive director of Fair Contracting Foundation.
Okay.
We're a nonprofit also that we deal with labor compliance.
Okay. So the two of you, and we're going to be expecting a phone call here on D10, and as soon as we get to that, we'll let him come in and talk a little bit. But the two of you recently made a trip and had some pretty good experiences. Stephen, you want to start us out and tell us a little bit of what was going on?
Sure. We started from, we all participated in the Cross-Border Labor Organizing Council, which is a project of PCASC, the Portland Central America Solidarity Council.
Which is part of Jobs for Justice.
Formally, we're all part of the labor family.
One big happy family.
Yeah. So we went to Venezuela for 5 days, and then we spent 5 more days in Colombia. And because of the short nature of the trip, we spent most of the time just in Caracas and then in Bogota.
Okay. And folks, right now on the phone is Ben Nelson. Ben, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm just fine. And on December 10th, and rightfully named D10, we have an event going on that ties into what my two guests are going to talk about, human rights. You want to tell us a little bit about that event?
Yeah, it's going to be, as you said, of course, December 10th, this Sunday, 5 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the evening, at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall, 345 Northeast 8th. And we're going to be having a kind of a strategy session to discuss how we can capitalize on some of our recent political victories. December 10th is International Human Rights Day, and we're celebrating and moving the message forward that workers' rights are human rights. So we're going to be talking with activists and organizers and workers in the community about how we can take advantage of some of our recent political success.
And again, the date and the address and all of that again?
That's going to be this Sunday, December 10th. 5 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the evening at the Portland Association of Teachers Union Hall, located at 345 Northeast 8th.
Okay, Ben, and if I come, what can I expect?
Well, you'll expect to hear from several speakers. We'll be talking about issues on a local level, some policy of the city of Portland around pay or play for health care, some issues at the state level, some strategies, some statewide strategy, discussion about the Employee Free Choice Act and the Kentucky River issue at the federal level. We'll hear from some experts on those topics, and then we'll have table discussions around how to move those ideas forward.
So this is pretty broad-ranged, is from what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Well, we've had some good success at different levels of government, so we want to talk about what things we can move at all those different levels.
Okay. Well, and Dana, you mentioned the Employee Free Choice Act. I did a show on that once. I had Congressman George Miller in from California, and he talked about that. Of course, that was several years ago, and it hasn't gone anyway. Are we hoping to push that in with the way the elections went this time? Is that one of our goals?
Oh, absolutely. We've got a fair bit of support on that issue. A lot of our Congress people have signed on to support that, so we need to make sure that we maintain our support and then bring some of the new folks on board. Hopefully we can bring that issue, to the floor and get a vote on it. It's up to us to hold those folks responsible.
Right. And just talking to you, there are different levels of human rights, I guess is what I can say. And these two gentlemen in here tonight, we're going to talk about Central America and what's going on down there. But even when you come into this country, what it was 20 years ago, 10 years ago, or today is certainly different. And what we're trying to prevent is getting worse in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Is that fair to say that?
Oh, yeah, I agree with you 100%. We're seeing workers' rights. Certainly would argue those are human rights, and those have been eroded certainly over the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, okay, as we've seen our union density decline, and we need to turn that around. Or we'll just see continuing decline in human rights.
Okay, well, Ben, and you and I will get together. I want to do a couple more shows on the Employee Free Choice Act. I think that's very important. So, again, why don't you give the date, the time, and the place, and what's going on, and then we'll get back to our guests in the studio.
Okay. Again, a conversation around how to take advantage of some of our recent political victories here on December 10th, International Human Rights Day. That's this Sunday, 5 o'clock in the evening till 8 o'clock. Portland Association of Teachers Hall, located at 345 Northeast 8th here in Portland. Hope to see everyone there.
Ben, any cost for this?
No cost at all. Of course not. We'll have some dinner there for you.
Oh, excellent. So come on down and get a nice dinner, and let's talk about how we can help working people in this country.
Absolutely.
Okay, Ben, I appreciate you calling in, and folks, it'd be a great thing to attend. So thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye. So Steve, and I apologize. I wanted to get him in while he was on the phone. He's in the middle of a meeting, and I knew when he called I wanted to drop him in there. So you recently took some time off, went to some countries in Central America, and expecting to see human rights violations, I would imagine, as you're going there. What you saw, was it what you expected, better or worse? Where are we at?
Well, the delegation was really twofold.
Okay.
In Venezuela, what we were expecting to see, I don't think anybody really had any high expectations. It was having the opportunity to witness what was happening under the Chavez government firsthand, because it's really hard to get good information about that in the United States.
Right.
And particularly with regards to labor unions and how the role that labor unions have played in Venezuela is what they're calling El Proceso, which is the Bolivarian Revolution under Hugo Chavez. And in Colombia, I think we knew coming in we were going to be seeing a lot of issues around human rights and labor rights. I mean, Colombia has the worst record of any country in the world. If you took every country in the world and combined them, more labor union leaders are killed in Colombia every year than everywhere else combined.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So if you're a labor leader in Colombia, you really have to have a lot of courage to really believe in the movement.
It was interesting. I mean, I'm sure Daniel had the same experience as me, but as an organizer, I've spent a lot of time working with workers and going through the process of helping them form a union and build a union for the first time. The issues and the concerns and the process is very similar. A worker is a worker no matter where on the planet you are. And 9 times out of 10, we're dealing with the same companies. But the difference in Colombia was, instead of risking your job, you're risking your life.
You could be disappeared.
Yeah, in some ways, it felt like a lot of elements about Colombia felt like we were looking into the past, into our own labor history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people there's two different participants of the delegation from the ILWU, and there was a lot of comparisons made with the Bloody Thursday and the struggle that the longshoremen went to form their union, because it was just so many parallels that you could draw.
Daniel?
Yeah.
Is that the same way you saw that?
You know, one of the strange things for me was that I'm used to traveling in places of Latin America. Colombia, just because of the fact that I'm associated with the labor movement, was one of the few places I've actually felt a little frightened. Hmm. And, you know, you can see I'm not the kind of guy, that would normally be a target. I can usually hold my own, but I was actually a little bit scared there, to tell you the truth.
Afraid of getting into the conversation with the wrong person, is that?
That, being marked, there's just a lot of things that people are always looking over their shoulder. If you're a union, leader, you're always looking over your shoulder there. Mm-hmm. You can't wear your any kind of identifying T-shirt or anything like that.
So is that violence supported by the government? How does this all come down?
Well, let me put it this way.
There's, I mean, why do people always go against their own best interests is what I'm
right.
Ask.
You'd have to put it this way. The government does not officially condone those kinds of things, but there is the government does have a lot of laws in place that make it very difficult to form unions. There's certainly no great effort on the part of either the Colombian government or the U.S. government, which is there with a lot of aid, to really do anything serious about this. While we were there, two teachers were killed, were murdered while we were there. We were at the offices of the teachers' union the following day, And then the delegation, I wasn't at that particular meeting, but I understand that the delegation, Steve, you brought that up with one of the American officials there, didn't you?
Yeah, we met with the labor attaché to the U.S. Embassy in Colombia. You know, and the what happens with the violence is that Colombia is a dangerous country. There's a lot of paramilitaries, and they've been the history of almost half a century-long civil war. But the line is invisible between where the paramilitaries begin and where, you know, official government begins, and the relationship between private business is blurred even farther. So, for example, we met another... Teachers are one of the biggest targets of violence, murder, and assassinations. But we also met with the workers of Coca-Cola, who...
Right.
In their story, I mean, and a lot of labor activists in the U.S. have heard of it, what's happened, but to hear it firsthand and to hear how a paramilitary was just given complete impunity to walk right into the plant, right up to a union leader, assassinate them right there in front of everybody else and walk back out of the plant. You know, even though Coca-Cola didn't pull the trigger and even though the Uribe government, or I think this might have actually been before Uribe, but the government itself didn't do it.
No one stopped them.
Nobody stopped it from happening.
Right, and you know, unfortunately, I think that's one reason I really like this radio station and this program. We did a piece years ago on the Coke, and you just don't hear or see this on mainstream media, and certainly, you know, I know I don't drink any Coke products, and I'm not even saying they had anything to do with it. It's just they didn't stop it. And they didn't try and do anything after it either, I think, is what kind of disappoints me. And all this boils down to people just trying to better their lives. Is that what the struggle is over?
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's what the labor movement is about everywhere, is people wanting to be able to collect
their bargain. But it's not as violent everywhere.
No, but the desire to improve your life. The thing in Colombia was very, it was frankly depressing, and I hope maybe we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about Venezuela, because that's the absolute opposite of what's going on there. But, you know, if you want to keep on about
it. Sure, no, keep on. Just wherever you need to be.
Yeah, just wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Bolivarian Revolution and Venezuela now. We went to Venezuela first, and all of us, there were nine of us on the delegation, completely blown away by the energy and the power of the movement. The Venezuelan Constitution actually has in the Constitution itself labor rights, among other things, including environmental rights and some other things. But it's interesting that the right to form unions and all of the kinds of things that a lot of which we don't even a universal right to form unions and to belong to unions, which we don't even have here. I know that The gentleman was speaking about the Kentucky River situation. These kinds of things that we have here in this country, you don't have that in Venezuela. Their constitution guarantees them those rights. And it's getting translated down now into the people. The process down there is that people are taking control of the means of production. They're forming cooperatives. They're forming community groups. And it's really exciting. There's a radio station down there.
With the KBOO sticker on the wall.
Yeah. Oh no, really?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think they admire this station, in fact, and it's called Radio Primero Negro. And we had a chance to speak on that radio station also. And it's just a very exciting, very positive thing now with the recent election and Rosales conceding defeat without going into, you know, an attempted coup. It's a very exciting time for all of us.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this show, I don't know, six, 7 years, somewhere in that area. And I generally stay in the United States about our issues right here, and I very seldom do I travel outside of these, you know, the two borders here, because I don't think I really want to know what's going on down there. I'm kind of afraid to know what's going on down there. But I got to tell you, over the past few years, the more I see what's happening to labor in this country and the multinationals and globalization and all that, I become to realize that, wait a minute, we're all in this together.
Absolutely, and that's why it was so important what we did, and because we have to form these connections with the labor movement throughout the world.
Right.
I think not only because, you know, we are all in the same fight together and to recognize our allies across borders, but also, you know, for me, having come into the labor movement as a young lefty idealist, and then getting burnt out more and more over the years, and with the labor movement in the U.S.
happens to the best of
us. with the labor movement in the U.S. going through so many changes recently, and us trying to figure out, you know, what does a labor movement look like in the 21st century with the loss of manufacturing jobs, with under neoliberalism, under the globalization of all these different companies, and, you know, the line blurring between corporate and government. For me, I was really looking to find other models to see, well, what are workers just like us doing in other countries? What can we learn from them? Because what we're doing here isn't working. And I think that, you know, to see the struggle in Colombia, where there's a lot of things that are very similar to the United States, you know, a lot more violent repression of unions, but the struggles are so similar, and the structure of their labor movement and how they're building that movement between worker to worker, person to person, and then to see the same contrast but to see it happening in Venezuela so successfully.
Well, I really don't see us, the United States, that far away from violent times for labor unions. I mean, a lot of people, I know a gentleman used to do this show called Gene Lawhorn, and he used to do a lot of labor history. And I don't think, I'll bet today most workers don't have an idea on a lot of our labor history and the struggle and the bloodshed and the people that died and the struggle that it was. And I think we became very complacent in the 50s and the 60s. And then in the 70s, I think we almost started losing membership and to where we are today. So I see us on that downward slide. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, when you actually bring this up to other people, I mean, you two are sitting here shaking your head, yes, you know, but when you bring this up to other people, they look at you like you're nuts. Well, we could never be violent in this country over labor issues, you know.
Yeah. Colombia did feel like we were looking into our own future in a lot of ways.
Is that right?
Yeah. You know, and one of the things about Gene's program is something that I found very kind of scary. And Gene was working on getting a memorial bill for a massacre that happened back east, and the weird thing was it was very hard to get information about it. You know, people had forgotten, the records weren't good, and we're forgetting our past, we're forgetting those past struggles, and what do they say about history? You're doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely.
And
I said Columbia. That Columbia was our past earlier in the same conversation.
Yeah,
I think
now
it's our future.
Future. Yeah, yeah. And that is, hey, you know, we're labor people here, dyed-in-the-wool unionists, and that could be our future, and we have really got to do something now.
Yeah, you know, you say that, and some people may look at you as though, oh, no, you know. And I mean, when you get right down to it, folks, and you break it down, whether you belong to a union or don't belong to a union, I think there's something all of us have in common, is we have a job. And when we go to that job, what do we want out of that job? We just want to be able to be treated with respect and to be able to afford what I used to call the American dream. I honestly think some of the youth in this country today doesn't even have a clue on what the American dream is anymore, because we've gotten so far away from that. And so when you stereotype yourself, I don't want people to get it in a bad light. Yeah, I'm a trade unionist also, and all that means is that I want my fair share. I want to be treated with respect. I want to have a decent wage. I want to be taken care of when I retire. And, you know, I don't think that's too much for asking. So what are the bright spots that you saw? And maybe one of you can talk about Venezuela and the other one can talk about Colombia.
I'll go ahead on Venezuela. We were there first.
Yeah, easy one.
Yeah, that was an easy one. The bright spots. What wasn't bright about it? It was the energy level, they have these social programs that are called misiones, and the Chavez government is using the oil wealth to have free schools. And I'll tell you this one, we were with this group of women that was called
Manos Amigas.
Manos Amigas, and I was sitting there next to this grandmother, and she was telling us about how when the Chavez initiatives began, that she was able to go to school and learn to read, and this is just within the last few years. And she was so excited about that, and the women there had taken control of their own destinies, and they were working. We saw that all over the country. Every place we went was just a wonderfully positive thing. There are some, I imagine, some good things in Colombia, but
So before we go on, though, I mean, it's leadership.
It's
the empowering.
It's the empowering of the people.
But that can't happen without leadership.
Let's put it this way: the leadership is there.
Right.
And what they have done is facilitated the people the people's ability to take control of their own destinies, and it's collective action.
Mm-hmm.
This is you're seeing a very strong sense of community developing around.
Of course you do. People start caring.
Yes, exactly.
Imagine that. Imagine caring about your community and caring about going to school and caring about roads and caring about, geez, wouldn't that be a great place to live?
Yeah, exactly.
Steve?
I'd like to see that kind of thing here. I really would.
I think the amazing thing, though, about Venezuela, though, is that it wasn't just that it was in the leadership of Chavez. I mean, Chavez is enormously popular. I've never been anywhere where the political leadership of a country was that amazingly popular. But I myself was a little bit skeptical of any kind of drastic social transformation that happens from the top down.
Right.
What I found and what blew me away by being there was that, well, people do love and respect Chavez and they're all voting for him, and they just did. He just won in a huge landslide victory yesterday.
Right.
It's the political space that's been created for all these other things to operate, for trade unions to flourish, for community groups to flourish, and the resources and the support that they're now able to have, that, you know, people are still critical of him, and they're critical of the government and the layer of bureaucracy in between, you know, Chavez and the people, but, and then they're, you know, free to say it, and they do say it all the time on the street, but there's this new space that's been created where all these other things can flourish now, and that was just beautiful to see.
We have about 10 seconds left. Aren't you two speaking somewhere?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tomorrow night, I mean, these issues are so big, it's too hard to...
Oh, okay. What's going on tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night, we're actually us, as well as the rest of the delegates from a variety of different unions, SEIU, AFSCME, LWU, I'm probably forgetting others.
SEIU.
Yeah. We're all speaking at the Carpenters Hall up on Lombard. It's 2215 North Lombard Street, and I think it's Lombard in Denver. It's our report back. It's the first time we're going to be, you know, explaining what we saw to everybody. I mean, obviously, these issues are bigger than we can get over in 10 minutes, but hopefully, if you can make it out tomorrow night, it starts at 7. At 6:30, doors open, and there's going to be some food and a little mini reception.
Okay. Is there a charge for this?
No charge. And it's going to be a very good thing. We're going to have a video, very exciting stuff. We'll have a few slides, but mostly... We're not going to talk too long. We're not going to bore anybody's socks off or anything like that. Come out. There's it's going to be a lot of fun, actually, because we're also going to be able to hopefully try to transmit some of that energy that we found in Venezuela to the meeting.
Are you allowed to ask questions?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's
going to
be lots of discussion.
You bet.
Okay. Yeah. That's. I mean, sometimes you go to things and it's somebody preaching and then you don't really get to get
No, no. This will be interactive, and we'd like to have you there if you can come.
Okay, that's tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. I know where the Carpenter's Hall is.
Yeah, that's the Carpenter's Hall. Mm-hmm. 247.
2215 North Lombard.
Right. And what time again?
It starts at 7, but at 6:30 doors will open. There'll be some food and probably something to drink.
Okay.
And Coach Shizuko.
And so do you want us to just keep going, Ben? Okay. And Kevin is not here yet. We understand he's in traffic somewhere. So let's just kind of continue on for a few extra free bonus minutes.
Oh, great.
You wanted highlights of Colombia?
Sure. Let's do that. Oh, we ran out of material.
Let me talk to speak just really quickly and then let Steve get his thoughts together. Colombia was a tremendous contrast. After Venezuela, the energy level was very low. And there was a good deal of concern. And my impression was that there's some people there that are very, very courageous just to even be labor leaders. You know you've got a target on your back.
Right.
Steve?
I think, you know, I'll just say one quick story about a moment we had with flower workers who work for Dole, who we're all familiar with because they're pineapple. But
that's one thing I wanted to ask earlier. These are a lot of multinational corporations that we find right here in the United States.
Definitely.
Okay, go ahead.
But we spent, you know, the day out visiting them in the towns, the communities that they live in, which are pretty much shanty towns, and meeting the workers. And, you know, we probably had 30 or 40 different workers come and show up and meet with us, tell us their stories of the struggles that they had. And at the end of the meeting, we taught them the farm worker clap, which anyone in the labor movement probably knows when everyone starts clapping and you start doing it together. But having worked with the UFW in California and hearing the same struggles and the issues of the workers, it was very, very similar, and it was great to see and experience that.
Yeah. And, folks, good news. Kevin Berry has been cited. He's in the building. He's heading back to the engineering room right now. And I think within about 30 seconds, he'll be on the air. So with that, I'd like to say thank you to all of my guests tonight. And Daniel and Stephen, appreciate you coming in. And, again, real quick, where's that tomorrow?
2215 North Lombard at the Carpenter's Hall. It's Lombard in Denver.
It's starts upstairs.
Upstairs, yeah. And it starts at 6:30.
Okay, and bring your questions, and there's going to be some food there, and can have a good time. And with that, I thank you for tuning in to Labor Radio. And Ben, thank you very much, and good night.
Across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns. It's